Welcome back to the Devin Kershaw Show. I'm Nat Herz from Fasters here. As promised, we're back after not very long with an episode even after the season is over, and it is with none other than Jesse Diggins. If you don't know who Jesse Diggins is, I do not know why you are listening to this podcast. That would be amazing. But, you know, just as a quick reminder, Jesse has a gold medal with Keegan Randle from the 2018 Olympics in South Korea, where that pair won the team sprint. Jesse won two more medals at the Olympics in 2022 in China in the individual sprint and in the 30-kilometer distance race. And then she was the overall World Cup champion this year. So I could probably go on. She has a trophy case that is probably the size of my 900-square-foot home here in Anchorage. But I'm not going to do that. We'll just get straight to it. I will also issue an apology for the failure to check my snow privilege in the last episode with Devin. It really has been a good winter here in Alaska, and we talked about that, and we're kind of chastising people for not doing more late season skiing. But it is true that a lot of North America has been snow deprived this winter. If you have already moved on to running and biking and roller skiing, I am genuinely sorry. And I definitely was lacking some self-awareness the other day. I will say the skiing here is still pretty good. So one other thing, Jesse Diggins has been really open about her struggles over her career and her life with an eating disorder. And that is a subject that before the podcast, we asked Jesse if she wanted to speak about, and she did. And so we do talk about that subject on this episode. If that is going to be hard for you to listen to, this is just a heads up that that content is going to be there. Also, if this is an issue you are personally struggling with or know someone who is struggling with an eating disorder, we definitely do not want you to be taking your cues from me or from Devin. There are a number of resources out there that we would refer to you, and we are going to include those in the notes to the show. So with that said, we will move on and get to the show. Thanks for being with us. This episode of the Devin Kershaw Show is brought to you by Boulder Nordic Sport. Boulder Nordic Sport is a shop that can get you your top-notch cross-country ski equipment, waxing, stone grinding, and hand-picked skis. You can be looking for your first set of new gear, trying to finish your 15th Berkey in style, or aiming for the 2024 Olympics. Boulder Nordic Sport's staff will help you find just the right gear to meet your needs. BoulderNordic.com has one of the biggest selections of ski stuff in the country. They also have a really fun annual magazine that you can download there digitally. You can also sign up for one of their professional race wax services for World Masters and other big events, and they've got extensive waxing how-tos on the BNS YouTube channel. That's all at BoulderNordic.com. What did we say, Devin? We were going to start by asking Jesse about classic technique. Was I going to do that, or were you going to?
No, I was going to do that because, like, that we're still, like, we haven't started yet or anything, Jesse. But we don't want to commandeer too much of your time. But just a bit of a heads up before we start. It's like the first question I'm going to ask for you about ask you is like, I've been like wildly impressed with your don't bury it. I just want to talk about your classic technique and how amazing it is now. That's it. That's how it's going to go. That's how it starts. So that's how you're prepared.
This is very fun for me to see your inner dynamic play behind the scenes.
Yeah. Let's start there. That's the question. Or
let's do it.
Reframe it.
Okay. Okay. Well, I have a question to start with here, Jesse. And I have noticed that your classic skiing, and not just the results, but the way you're skiing classic is just so incredible. And you've made such amazing improvements in 1 year. You have been getting better and better every year, of course. And your results have been great over a number of seasons now. But this year, especially, and especially in challenging conditions such as Falun or Davos, for example, you were really able to ski technically well in incredibly challenging conditions. And that's something I have not seen very many athletes, men or women, be able to do. I'm just curious about that. Like, was that a big goal of yours going into the season here, or is that something that's been happening for a long time?
Yeah, it's funny because it's very strange to me why in some conditions it has suddenly clicked, because I've always been working on it and I've always been working really, really hard on it. Like, I go down to New Zealand and I am so focused, and every single day it is multiple sets of drills, video, looking back on it. I mean, I'm not messing around. Like, I am trying so hard to improve, and technique has never been my strong suit. I'm super hyper mobile. It's really hard for me to keep things locked in and together, because my body literally wants to like fly in different directions. Like, my elbows go like this. I mean, it is actually really tough for me to keep things locked in. And so technique has always been like probably one of my weakest parts, technique and maybe power or something. But I honestly don't know why it came together this year. And my guesses are, one, the skis play so much into it. When you have, so like all of period one, it was super cold, natural snow. And we had fantastic skis race after race after race after race. So you get to the start line and you are so confident. When I put all my weight down on this ski, and when I ski with power and a long stride, it's going to connect. Like, it's going to work. And you start relaxing and your shoulders drop. And I'm saying the royal you, me, I start relaxing. I don't know how other people feel, but for me, I definitely change the way I ski, because I ski with confidence, and that really, really matters. And then, and also you had pretty good tracks as well. So it became more and more similar to roller skiing. And so I've always felt like more confident in those conditions. And then even in Davos, where, yeah, it was super, super tricky and really crazy, but you basically were going to double pull and herringbone, and you kind of knew that going in, and you just knew like no one's going to have good skis, pretty much. Everyone's just going to be messing around out there, and everyone's going to be like stepping on each other, herringboning, and you just sort of like accept the chaos and you go into it like that. And so then it's not a surprise, versus like in Lahti, where by my second lap, the track had turned into a unitrack. Like, it was one track. And so it was like, my knees don't go like I don't really know what to do with this. Like, you go in expecting one thing, and then your skis and the wax and the conditions are completely another, and you're caught by surprise. And so I think so much of that has to do with the confidence and how we've just improved all together, because I don't feel like I've actually really changed anything beyond just maybe one more year of hard work. Like, maybe it was like the last straw, but in a good way, you know. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's a good starting place. I guess like another question I'd say, like, I get it. I mean, I've raced too, so I understand what you're saying, but like, my jaw hits the floor even in, yeah, so cold, hard tracks, like you said, good skis, but your angles, you have like a high hip position, and you have a high hip position with your weight going right through the kick zone. Like you said, it feels like roller skiing, but like, from kilometer one to kilometer 10, weekend after weekend after weekend. And that has been so incredible to watch and awe-inspiring. And then with Davos, you're saying it's like, oh, it's just kind of a mess, and everyone's kind of a mess, and you're double pulling. But like, when you're double pulling, you're in a high position this year in really challenging conditions. When you're under the gun, you're leading the Tour de Ski, and you're hitting your angles every time. And when you're running, when you're herringboning, like, and then you just got to kind of run up the hill, as you and I both know well, Jesse, like, if your hips and your body angles are in the right place, like, Klebo makes running up the hill look pretty darn easy, because his angles are perfect every time. And like, if you don't have those angles, that herringboning can be such a challenge. And I guess, like, I just want to press you a little bit on that. Like, so you really are saying that it just happened gradually over time, and you are the consummate professional, always working on it, but nothing really clicked. Like, did it surprise you, I guess, is that long ramble? Like, were you surprised you were able to put it all together from kilometer one to 10 the whole time?
Well, because that's the thing. I don't feel like I did. Because like in Davos, well, that was very special because I literally sprained my ribs in like 1K into the race. So I don't feel like I was double pulling really well. I feel like it was like pretty sloppy. And I was literally trying to do as little as possible at all moments because I knew something was super wrong. And so, like, I think sometimes when I'm just going for efficiency, like how little can I get away with in this moment? Because the break will happen later in the race in a mass start. Or even like in Falun, like I looked back at some video and I was like, huh, that's some pretty loose skating. But I'm chilling in the back of the pack. Does it matter? I don't know. Like, I'm not sure if it does. So I guess maybe my technique is something that would only work for me, but I really don't feel like I'm done trying to work on it. And I feel like I mean, that's the cool thing about skiing is like, I'm never going to feel like I have it figured out. And as soon as I get close, it'll evolve and Clay will invent another style of technique and we'll all be trying to learn it. It'll be really exciting and confusing. And like, that's just how the sport is. But I don't know. I don't feel like I wish I had an answer because then that'd be so helpful because I could go back to my younger teammates and be like, "Ah, you just do this. You just do this one thing. It's so obvious." And so like if I knew, I'd be telling everyone, but I actually don't. And that's like what's kind of not frustrating. I'm glad to be skiing better than I was before, but it'd be really nice if I could figure out what exactly it was because I could save some people some headaches.
I was going to say it does actually sound a little frustrating, maybe not to have a clear sense of what the magic thing was that unlocked these results this year.
I have one more question with that, Jesse, about it. Like apropos of that, like what about with the results? So like you had such great results early in Classic this season and like phenomenal results as well as the technique, in my opinion, was amazing. Did that really help? Did you feel like there was a switch in confidence? It's like, oh my God, like this is working this year. Like I can do this. Or are you really focused on being present? What's your process with that in a technique that you have 10 years ago struggled more than your skating, for example?
Oh, for sure. And I definitely still struggle with it more than skating. Like that's okay to say. It's my weaker of the two by far. And especially when the conditions get weird, right? Like when conditions get really, really tough and break apart in skating, you can still get up the hill. But like in Classic, you may or may not be able, like it's like it actually really like changes things. So I think like, but I do think, you know, when you're having the results, because I don't focus on the results, but when you're in a mass start and you're like, okay, I'm skiing behind Ebba Anderson. She's so amazing. I really admire her. She's a great distance skier. She can get it done in Skating Classic. And if I'm still skiing behind her 15K into a 20K, I'm like, wow, this maybe I'm finally figuring it out, you know? Like you don't want to base it off of other people, but you know, based on where I would be sitting in the pack in a distance classic race, normally I'm shot off the back. And so when I'm still there and I still feel like I'm skiing with economy and I'm still able to kind of hold it together, like that's hugely confidence boosting because I think so much of it, I guess I shouldn't say so much, but a large chunk of it is believing that you can do it, right? Like you can believe you can do it, and then you might have, you know, a terrible race, you might fall, you might break your poles. Believing you can do it doesn't guarantee a good race, but if you believe that you absolutely cannot do it, it is very unlikely that you will have a good race despite yourself.
I was thinking about this. I didn't really have this on my list of questions, but it sort of, particularly after watching that last race in Falun this past weekend, and for people that didn't watch that last the distance race, the last race of the season, you should watch it. It was pretty fun. 20K skate race, and Jesse basically just like went to the front with like 5K to go and just kind of killed everyone nicely. It was pretty fun to watch. And I don't, I am like that question of confidence. I'd love to hear like a little bit more about how you feel like that has evolved for you over the years to where like my sense is that like Jesse Diggins of 5 years ago or even 2 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, like at times you might have had the capacity to like do that, and maybe the results are different when Teresi Ohag was still racing, but nonetheless, like, you might not have had the confidence to do that. And like the idea that like you could sort of take control of a race and like sort of dictate the outcome like you did on Sunday. Like, I'm curious sort of how you feel like your confidence in the women's field has like evolved and changed and grown over the years, and like what you sort of think you can do in a race setting like that.
I think that's a good question, because as you pointed out, it definitely changes when you're trying to hold on for dear life to Mara and Teresa. You know, like your race strategy is like, well, I'm going to just hold on as long as possible, because me going to the front and taking control doesn't really work. So I think that definitely has shifted like how we race, because lately in distance races, especially with the mass starts, it kind of feels like it's anybody's game. And that's super cool. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't really know who the lead pack is going to come down to. It might be actually a lead pack, which is really neat. And I think that is actually really great for spectating. But I think for me, especially in skate, something that has been new for me this year is having the confidence to float around within the pack and trust that I can get to where I need to be when I want to be there. And so, for example, in Falun, I was like, all right, the bonus sprints, it's a really narrow course. I need to start positioning myself about a kilometer early. And I felt like I could get to where I needed to be, push the pace, and then come back and tuck into the pack. And for a while, I was sitting, I don't know, like ninth or 10th or something. I was sitting in the pack just chilling. And then when I knew I had to get back to the front, I felt like, okay, and I can get there right now when I want to. And that's something that I never had before. Before, I probably would have been scrambly. I would have stayed out at the front out of desperation, not because I wanted to be. And I would have tried to just push the pace simply because I thought that was my only chance, not because I believed that I could turn on the jets when I had to. And I still don't necessarily feel that in classic. Classic, it feels like more like, hey, I might have a lucky shot here and there, but I'm trying to just hang on and then see what happens. But skate races, I feel like I can execute more of a plan and let the plan evolve and be flexible during the race. And that is something that I think is new this year.
Well, about that, Jesse, like, do you attribute that to experience, confidence, or just being in incredibly good shape this winter? Because you were the best female cross-country skier from start to finish. Like, what do you attribute it to, what you were describing, especially in the mass start skating, to move around in the pack and kind of make the moves happen and feel that you can make them when you want?
I wish I had like a concrete answer, but I think it's kind of a combination of all those factors. Right, confidence for sure. Because like we said earlier, if you don't believe you can do it, you can't. And also confidence in my ability to move around without getting stepped on and stepping on other people, and just confidence that like I will see the window and be able to have spatial awareness of where other people are. Like really early on in my career, sprinting was so hard for me because I had to put 100% of my focus into trying to make my body move down the track as fast as possible, that there was so little energy left over for feeling a sense of where the other women are. And even more so sensing when someone's getting tired and then there's going to be a gap here. And if I need to move, I can go right now. I couldn't do that. I simply didn't have the capacity. And so I think I have that capacity now. And a lot of it is experience and then better fitness. And then also you start to get to know who you're racing with. And that's a really cool and interesting thing. I feel like, especially amongst a lot of the women who have been on the World Cup for a long time, there's such a mutual respect. And so, for example, in Falun, I led a bunch of it. And then at one point I looked back in the stadium and I was like, Heidi, help me. And she went to the front. And she took a pole. And it was like, because we're friends, we're team 1991. We've been doing this together for a really long time. And there's a lot of us on team 1991, you know? And I think like there is something to be said for you get to know the people you're with. You get to know who can I ski around where if they're skiing right behind me, there's going to be a level of respect. They're not going to step on my poles. They're not going to do this. They're not going to be scrambly. Like, we're going to chill and work together because we have 20K to go. Like, it's okay. And so I think that's also a big part of it, is understanding like who you're navigating around.
I think that's a good segue, sort of talking about like the attention you had to, like, when you were younger, sort of putting into like just sort of staying in control in your own body versus like your awareness. One of the things that I feel like has been a perennial or almost weekly subject of discussion on this podcast has been like Jessie Diggins burying herself and how hard Jessie buries herself. And I feel like it's also, I mean, when people write about skiing that aren't us and don't know about skiing, I feel like that's also like something that like people love to talk about. And one question that I feel like has kind of bubbled to the surface and that like we get emails about and when we talk about or allude to, with full respect to your desire not to judge or cast aspersions on any other women in the field, I am curious, like, do you see that as a Jessie Diggins specific superpower that in some ways like you can go deeper and harder, or do you feel like actually everyone goes equally hard and you just are like more sort of less restrained in like showing what that does to your body during a race or at the end of a race?
That is such an interesting question. It would be really cool to have some way to actually know the answer. Like, if you could measure pain.
Well, we could, like, lactate is a proxy for that in some way. Oh, Devin says
I'm going to jump in on that because physiologically speaking, it's not, because, you know, like Jessie could probably have a lactate of like 26 because she has some sprinting capabilities where like Terezi Yohag's never going to have a lactate over 11. And they're both, and they're some of the most they're both the best distance racers in the world on different years. So I'm just going to jump in about like, if you're going to use markers to measure pain, lactate isn't the best one, but it is a marker for today. If Teresa's highest ever lactate ever recorded is 11.6, and she has a lactate at the end of a 30K or now 50K of a 11.5, you can rest assured that is probably has never been gone harder. And likewise with Jessie, I don't know what your lactate PB is, but if you're within 0.1 or 0.2 of your lactate PB, rest assured you left it all out there. But it's very hard to compare between athletes. Just that said.
No, that's a really good point, because you really can't. And also everyone experiences pain differently, right? So like if all three of us stuck our hand in an ice bucket for as long as possible, and we all had to keep it in there for the same amount of time, like we're all going to be in pain, but we're going to experience it differently, and we'd probably rate it differently. And it's just, it's going to show up so differently on each of us. So I think like, and also it's definitely a thing, especially when it's super technique dependent, like in classic skiing for me, where let's say on a scale of 1 to 20, if I go a 20, the wheels are coming off because I literally can't feel my legs. I mean that actually literally can't feel them. It's super hard to kick your classic skis when you feel nothing below the waist because they're numb. And so if I pull it back to like 18, I'm still suffering massively, but I might be able to keep it together and therefore actually go faster. Versus in skating, I feel like it can get really ugly, but I know I can keep moving, so I can push it to a 20. And so I think it depends on the race, and I can't say how other people experience it, but I do know that in talking with other athletes, if I say like, oh yeah, like, you know, my vision like tinted pink, they're like, what the fuck? I'm like, sorry, I swore, but they're like, you what now? And like, I remember like, I think it was Gus or somebody said to me after a really, really good race, they were like, I couldn't feel my legs. Like for the first time, you know, and I was like, hey, got it. Like, so I think it just shows up differently for different people. But I do know that being willing to suffer so much is probably the only reason I get the results I have, because my technique is not that impressive and I don't have the most power and speed and all those different things. Right. And so if I wasn't willing to suffer, I wouldn't be able to out-ski my capacity. because I think I've got a very normal capacity. And the only thing that makes it abnormal is my brain. That's what I think, but open for discussion.
No, I've actually had an interesting question about that. Just like a follow-up question with that, Jesse. Is that something that you've worked on throughout your career? Is this fairly innate? Because like in my career, you know, with like sports psychology, for example, strategies, positive self-talk, for example, visualization before the race, but then also just trying to let it happen in the race, like being fully present. You have an amazing ability to get to that place kind of like race after race. Not every single race, of course, not like every single race. You have to go so deep to get the result you want. I mean, that's called life. But what do you think about that? Is this just something that that determination is just so innate and in you? Or is that something that you've really had to like battle? Like kind of, were you ever scared of the pain, I guess is a question. Or was this something that would always feed you and kind of motivate you?
I love that question. I think probably most of it is innate. And I think I get a lot of it from my dad. Like he has the highest pain tolerance of anyone I've ever met. And he never complains about anything ever. Like I think it was like a month before the 2018 Olympics, he had to get the surgery on his foot where they like break your bunion and saw it off and pin it back. And his foot looked like a Frankenstein foot. And a month later, he was walking around to cheer for me. He should not have been walking. It must have been excruciatingly painful. Didn't say a word. Just did not say a word. And it's just like, I think I just grew up with examples of not putting yourself through pain for no reason. But if it's not, if pain is in your way to the thing that you want, then it's not an acceptable excuse. Basically, you know, like you can bulldoze through that shit if you need to. And so that's the way I've always been. But I also think it's a really interesting and really dangerous part of my personality. So I have the intensity and the drive within me. And this is the same drive that makes me quite susceptible to an eating disorder, right? I'm willing to suffer so much and I'm very, very good at suffering. Now that's great as a ski racer. That's not a great quality in life if you are potentially in a dangerous situation or in a lot of pain and there's no reason to be. So I think so much of it is innate. But then when it comes to ski racing, I have worked on it and honed it to the point where I can push through things that are really, really tough. And sometimes that actually freaks me out. Like at the 22 Olympics and that 30K, like I probably should have gone to a hospital. Like I was actually like not seeing, I was like blind for a little while and I couldn't breathe and it was really bad. And it took me 2 months to climb out of that hole. Like it shattered me. I was so messed up. Like truly I did some serious damage to myself and I can just push through that in a race, but that's not always a good thing. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to figure out is like, yeah, there's a time and place to go all the way into the pain cave. And I need to be really cognizant of where those limits are, because if you go all the way at the start of the season, you might tank your whole year. It's very possible.
Well, in retrospect, was it worth it for a silver medal at the Olympics?
You know, it was. Also because I proved to myself that I could do some really hard things. And, you know, thinking back on that, you know, like this summer when I was really struggling, I'm like, man, I can do really hard things. I know I can. I've done it, you know, and I can push through things when I need to, when I think that it's worth it, you know? And so, but yeah, it was a really steep price to pay. That's for sure.
Yeah. They don't give those, Olympic medals out like party favors. So, well, maybe that is also a good segue. And, you know, I think I'd also want to be clear for listeners that, you know, I'm going to throw a question out there that we kind of discussed with Jesse, like before we actually started recording. And so we're not just kind of randomly jumping into this conversation. But you know, Jesse, you were like really public about the fact that you were kind of struggling with your eating disorder at the beginning of sort of heading into the season. And like now that the season is over and you've kind of like been through all of it and have sort of the perspective to kind of look back at what you were dealing with in the summer and just sort of how that then kind of led into this kind of a season, like what are your takeaways from that sort of part of your experience of the past year?
Yeah. You know, because I don't regret sharing it at all, because I think one of the biggest takeaways that was really meaningful for me was hearing feedback from so many people saying like, wow, I really needed to hear your words because I had a relapse with my eating disorder, or, you know, I started struggling with anxiety again or depression again. And there's this thing that happens sometimes when you feel like, oh, I should have, and I'm using air quotes, I should have beaten this. I should be over this and I'm not. And what does that say about me that I'm struggling with this again? And it can make you feel so less than, and it can make you feel super ashamed or guilty or scared. And it, you know, there's this moment where you're like, wow, I feel like I'm back to square one. I'm asking for help again. But I'm not, like, I'm not, because the fact is I know I need to ask for help. And I know now that I can get better, and I know it's very possible. And I also know the only way I get to be happy and healthy and actually have meaningful connections with all the people in my life, not to mention keep my job as a skier, is when I am healthy. And that's the only way it's going to happen. And so I feel like it was so important for me to reach out for help. And I spent the last 12 years still working with my sports psychologist and building this really strong safety net so that if something happened, we had a plan in place. It wasn't just like, oh, I don't know what to do. Like it was really, really cool to feel like I had such amazing support around me. And then the other thing that I take away from it is that since I told everyone what was going on, my team and my coaches were there for me. And they knew that I might need some extra hugs at different points. And they knew like, oh, wow, like going into the end of the season, there is a lot of pressure on Jesse. Like she is getting followed by multiple cameras all the time. People are talking about her all the time. Like maybe she might need a game of like hearts or whatever. Like maybe we need to go for a walk. And so I felt like I had so many people who were there for me and who were like, hey, I got you. And that was really amazing because it can feel so scary to let people in when you're struggling with anything. But then my experience time again is that when you let people in, you get a chance to see how much they really love you and how much they're there for you, like no matter what. And that's really cool. And the other reason I wanted to share is because I think there's such misinformation and stigma in our society still that eating disorders only affect skinny white teenage women. And that's just not true. You know, they can affect anyone, any age, any race, any gender. And it can be really, really hard on people if they don't, you know, quote, fit that stereotype of having an eating disorder. And so I guess one of the reasons I wanted to share that is because if somebody is struggling, or if someone listening to this podcast is struggling, just know that you can reach out for help and that that is the single best thing you can do. But also if someone reaches out to you for help, I think the best responses that I have received, including this summer from my coaches and my friends, was for them to say, wow, I'm really sorry that you're going through that. I really love you and I care about you. And I want to be there for you. Like, how can I help? I understand that I can't fix it. And it's not my job to fix it. I'm not an eating disorder trained specialist. I'm not a dietitian. But I just want to be there to have your back. You know, if you need someone to hold your hand while you make the call to get an appointment, I'm there for you. But they also understood, like, it's not their job to fix it. And that removes the burden of, you know, you don't have to be everything for this person. You just have to be their support. Like, you just have to, like, love them. And that's it. And so I think sometimes we get so scared when people want to share something with us, like, oh my God, now I'm going to have to like, now I'm going to have to fix this for them. Like, you don't. And so I think that's, yeah, it's an important barrier to get over.
Is it, I'm curious about like the terminology, and this is like definitely like not an area where I'm qualified or competent, but also, you know, I've kind of absorbed a little bit through like, you know, different people in my life that have like struggled with this. And I think like, I don't know, my experience is like it kind of feels like, you know, there are lots of numbers that get sort of thrown around about out there about like how many people experience an eating disorder. But my sense is like, it's almost like more normal that people experience an eating disorder than not. Like these numbers are like huge. And I'm curious, like your use of the term relapse, like is how sort of considered is that? Because my sense is like, do you feel like it's really sort of something that you can just like cure and have gone, or it's more like this is like, it's sort of like a health problem that like, you know, you can kind of keep it at bay, and it like ultimately over time will like go up and down, but it's not necessarily something that you can ever just like count on as being like gone. I don't know.
Well, that's a good question. And the disclaimer is that I'm not the trained expert, so this is just my understanding from working so closely in the space. But I liken it, I think the analogy that makes most sense to me is if you liken it to alcoholism, right? So like when someone says, I'm sober, it's like, okay, you're not drinking right now, but it takes work every day for you to choose to be sober and to be in that good place. And it's always going to be something that this little part of your brain has to protect itself against. And likewise, if I say like, I'm in recovery, it's like, I'm doing great. I'm, you know, like, worry about, you know, those eating disorder thoughts are not the predominant thoughts. Like maybe they're not even there at all. Like for a large part of those 12 years, like there were entire years where like totally fine, like not struggling in any way with it. And I felt super, I shouldn't say normal because I don't know what normal is, especially in our society with that, especially in the United States, it's very steeped in diet culture. So maybe there is no real normal, but I would say, you know, I'm in recovery and it takes some effort, but I'm in a good place. And so if somebody struggling with alcoholism starts drinking again, that would be like more of a relapse, right? And so to me, going back to the use of my eating disorder symptoms and behaviors and thought patterns, that was the relapse versus being in a place of recovery where, you know, sometimes those thoughts drift by, but it's kind of like seeing like a log drift by in the stream. You're like, oh, I see that it's there, but I'm not going to run out and get on it. Like, I'm just going to like watch it float by and that's fine.
Yeah. Versus like taking out your dock.
Yeah, exactly.
I had a question, Jesse, about that. So like when you're in the midst of this, this relapse, like you were talking about in the summer, what happened with the training and the planning? Because I just know, as someone else like myself, like I like things to be like planned out and like have kind of a good understanding what I need to do. And then, you know, I'm always showing up 10 minutes early and I love it. Cause it's just like, if I'm getting close to the deadline, I'm freaking out. But like, so you recognize these behaviors, you recognize these symptoms and you have this experience, you reach out, you're supported, but then there's also the job to do as a professional ski racer. And that means like training your ass off and also traveling quite a bit, as you've alluded to. You don't need to get into the nitty gritty details, but like you're open, this is happening, you're struggling, you talk with your team about it, but there's still training and work to do up towards the season. And what did that look like? And how was that like another hurdle you had to jump over to kind of like allow yourself to be like, okay, I guess we had planned 80, 95 hours this month and these trainings, and now we're gonna have to readjust and I'm gonna have to be okay with it? Or was it more fluid, if you know what I mean? Does that question make sense?
No, totally. And it's a great question because that's a huge part. It's a huge barrier for people who are going into treatment for eating disorder, whether it's training or like, I have school, I have classes, I'm a parent, I have a job. Like it takes so much time and mental, emotional energy to go to, through the process of getting better. And, you know, you got the one energy bucket, like that energy's coming out of it and you only have a finite amount of energy, right? We all have limits. So I think that's a really great question, because oftentimes it is so hard to put aside the, here's what I feel like I need to do right here, right now. And this makes me feel safe. And this gives me confidence in order for like what future me needs right now. And so I think that's a, honestly, that's why I was so shocked that this season had the results that it did, because so much of my mental, emotional energy was not going towards skiing and not going towards thinking about tactics and technique and all those things. A lot of it was going towards recovery, which is where it needed to go. And that was the priority, but we had to be a little bit flexible. And so one of the very first people that I told was Cork, who has known me since I was 18. He knows my whole history. He's so supportive and he's basically like family. I mean, he is family at this point. And so he was like, all right, like we're going to be really flexible. We're going to, you know, we're going to be fluid. And also he knows that's really hard for me. I'm really type A and I really love my plan and I love to check the boxes and I love following my plan and I cling to my plan as if my life depends on it. And so to be totally honest, a big part of me getting better was like, well, let's not change everything. Like, we're not going to take away your life raft. We're not going to make you stop training. We're going to be fluid and we're going to adjust. But, and you know, if I come to training one day and I'm like, I just can't, I'm really overwhelmed. He's like, cool, we'll cut it. Like, go do some yoga, like go foam roll. Like that's your training for the year. You know what I mean? So, but I think a big part of it is we didn't change everything. So like, I still really wanted to go to Park City and be surrounded by the team and all those fun team building activities and playing charades with everyone. And like, that's a huge part of me. And what makes me is like being part of this group. And that gives me a lot of meaning and a lot of direction and also a lot of motivation for getting better, because I'm like, I want to be part of this group and I want to be a really good role model to my younger teammates. And so when I'm here at camp, I want to take care of myself for me because it's the right thing to do. But as additional motivation, I want to take care of myself because there are people watching me and I need to show them like, this is, you know, how to be a professional athlete. You take care of yourself. So, I'm not sure if I totally answered your question, but, we ended up with a little bit of a mix of being a little bit flexible and also not removing all the things. And it was also, I guess it's important to also acknowledge that the doctor I'm working with also doesn't believe in cutting off all movement. Now, is there a stage in your eating disorder at which that might become necessary? Absolutely. You know, if it gets to a really, really dangerous place, then maybe we're not training and we're not racing, right? And so we're always evaluating that. And so it was, I guess it's important for me to acknowledge that I wouldn't have been training and racing if my care team didn't agree that was a good thing for me to be doing. And I think that speaks to the fact that we got to it fast enough that I was still able to continue those things in my life.
Oh, that was great perspective, Jesse. Thanks.
Yeah. I think it's really, I don't know. It's like, this is, I feel like, you know, for people who are thinking about this and dealing with it, it's like, I think Jesse acknowledged, like, there are lots of sources of information. And I think it's like, there are also, you know, people need to be like working with like experts and doctors, but I think also to be able to sort of hear the lived experience is really helpful. So like, appreciate your willingness to go into that. I have one question. It's something that like, I think a couple of people sort of brought up, like watching you go through this season, which is like, sort of watching the sequence of like, you struggled with the eating disorder kind of during training, and then you came into the season after having dealt with that and like performed at a level that you like never have before. And sort of, there's kind of this like, you know, I don't think this is anything that like you're obligated to answer or speak to, but I think there's sort of been this like implication that I've heard from a couple folks where it's like, you know, did that have an effect on her performance, and are women watching that? And like, how should women be talking about that and thinking about that, and, or not thinking about it? And
not just women. Not, Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Totally. You're right. You're right.
This is important to me, not just women. Yeah. Because this is if you're gonna go there, then this is something like any endurance activity, and not doesn't even have to be just endurance. This happens in the fashion industry for men and women. This is like this is not just women. Yeah, but go on. Sorry.
No, totally. So I just like I have to imagine this is something that probably is on your mind, and I'm really curious, like if that's something you thought about, and if there's anything sort of you feel like could be helpful for folks that have sort of been watching you and are trying to kind of like make sense of what's happened and how they should be sort of processing your season in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked it actually, because for example, back in 2018, when I first shared about my eating disorder, when I shared that I had gone through it in past tense, right? But one of the big reasons I wanted to share was because A, I thought it would help people, and B, I knew that eventually word was going to get out that, oh, Jesse Diggins had this eating disorder. And one of my biggest fears was that people in, you know, striving to reach their goals would think, oh my God, she only won an Olympic medal because of the eating disorder, not in spite of, not because she got recovered, but because she had this, right? And I wanted to make sure I set the record straight. Like, this almost derailed my life, not just my career, but the only reason that I was able to race well and have a career was because I got healthy and got help. And so similarly, I think this is a great question to be asking now, because I can see very easily where it would be really easy to draw conclusions and go, okay, she had a relapse and then she had a great season. Was it because of the eating disorder? And I think the reason I had a good season was because of maybe three things. I think the first was that I actually put no pressure and expectations on myself, because I didn't know what was like going into Ruka. I was like, this could maybe be like a real slow year. I don't really know. Who knows? Because things have not gone perfectly in the preparation phase, to say the least. And racing for the heck of it, not racing for anyone's expectations or any time or any results, but just going out there and just being like, I'm just going to do my best. That's it. That is so freeing. And I think that changed the way I race. I took more risks in terms of like, I'm going to try this pacing because really who cares? And I think it definitely opened me up to just racing with a lot more joy, because I was just so grateful to be there, because I almost wasn't. And so I was so much happier. And when I'm happy, I race faster. And so that is a huge part of it. I think the second part is, due to potentially having to be a little more flexible, I also was having to listen to my body so hard. And I think I came in more rested, like zero overtraining. You know, and athletes are often trying to find this line of like, how much training can I get away with? Because we're all numbers obsessed and everyone's on Strava and everyone wants to train the most. And it's really easy to get wrapped up in that. And I had to be wrapped up in, I need to feel good more often. And so I was feeling good more often. And I think not being overtrained at all was a huge part of why I raced faster. And I'm trying to remember what the third thing was now, because it was in my brain. It was kind of important. We'll come back to it. But
the unexplained classic technique, maybe.
Well, actually, yeah. The other thing, there we go, came back, was that our wax techs nailed it this season. And that also really, really matters. And we can't separate the results of the athlete from the results of the wax tech team, right? And like, I know this, like I have a medal from 2015 World Champs in Falun that I did not earn, because our techs nailed it in a snowstorm and Norway did not. And Marit Bjørgen and Teresa, best skiers of all time, should have been on that podium. And instead I was, because we had the best skis. It's super, super important, right? Even the best skiers in the world cannot out-ski skis that are not performing. And so, for me and for the whole team, like we had amazing support. Our support has been better and better every year behind the scenes. Like, for example, during the Tour de Ski, we had PT, massage therapist, a sport dietitian, making sure we had all the fuel we needed, which is huge. And the wax techs were nailing it. And like all those things combined come to a much better season result wise. So I think it's obviously a combination of things, but I do want to go on the record saying that had I not gotten help after my relapse, not only would there potentially not have been a season for me, it would not have been like this. It would not have been good results. And yeah, sure, maybe I would have had good results for a little bit of time. Maybe I would have come in hot and then burned out. And so there's always this thing that can sometimes happen with certain types of eating disorders where, yeah, maybe it works, quote, works for a little while, and then you will break, and that will be it. And I just think it's important for me to say that, because I know on the outside it can look like, aha, you know, maybe this was part of the success. But I think the success was despite the eating disorder.
Yeah, well, really appreciate you being willing to speak to that stuff. And I think we have like sort of just one or two other areas of questions. And another like convenient segue, you brought up Jason Cork, who one thing I really love about Jason Cork is and he's going to be like, he's listening. If he listens to this, he's going to be like, what is that love about me? This is weird. But I live in Alaska now, and I love that Jason Cork is from North Pole, because I feel like it just kind of explains a lot about him. Jesse, you've probably never been to North Pole. Devin, I'm sure you've never been to North Pole. It is a weird place. They literally have candy canes as the street lights. And there's like a, it's like right next to Fairbanks. It's like a, you know, kind of military suburb. Anyway, Jason Cork is like a figure in your career, Jesse, who I think, you know, as you alluded to, has pretty much been there every step of the way. But he is also more than I think almost any other person in the US sort of elite skiing world who hates attention. And so he never wants to talk to us, and always in sort of a good natured way, but you know, hard pass. No, thank you. And we thought it would be interesting to hear a little bit more about like your guys' relationship, because it seems like such like an important, he's been such like an important figure for you. And just wondering if you like could talk a little bit about like, how did you guys first sort of start working together, and how did the sort of relationship evolve into the one that you guys have now?
Yeah, I mean, Cork is such a legend, and he's so important to me. And I think I've said this before, but if he decided to quit, I might also have to quit. Like, he's huge. He's like everything. And he's not just my wax tech, he's also my coach. And he's also like, I think he's the smartest person I've ever met, which is saying something, because the ski world has some really smart people in it. And he's just such a student. Like, he's so curious. He's always reading every latest research article. He has a crazy good memory. And so if you're like, oh, what happened in this one ski race in the 80s? He'll be like, oh yeah, they used this wax and it was on this course and this person won. And like, he'll know everything about it. It's really amazing. But we met when I think I was 17 or 18. He went from Michigan Tech to working as the assistant coach for CXC. It was him and Fish. And at the time, I was doing some training camps with CXC. And then right when I graduated high school, I went full time with them. And at that point, I think that might have been his first year as the head coach. You have to fact check me. But he was either assistant or head coach. And I started working with him a lot. And we definitely took some time to like get to know each other and get to appreciate each other's quirks. And I can be really, really intense and really chatty, and he is less chatty than me. And so I feel like that's a big understatement, but I think we really play off each other really well. But now it's really funny because, for example, in Falun, we were sending each other dad jokes. And that's like our thing, is like really, really bad puns, like truly horrible. And it's just such a fun way to take a step back and see the big picture. Like, we both love our jobs. We love what we're doing. Yeah, there's a lot of pressure, a lot of noise. There's a lot going on this weekend. But like, isn't this a terrible joke? Let's laugh about it. And then after we tested skis, he could tell I was nervous, and he was like, okay, It's the one day a year, like, you can put glitter on my face. And so he let me glitter him up. And I feel like those little interactions just speak volumes to the fact that, like, I mean, he crops himself out of photos on his own Instagram, but he let me put glitter on his face because he knew that it would just be a really special thing for me and make me a little extra happy going into this last race of the season. And so I feel like he's just a really, really thoughtful person. And he's also one of the first people who will notice, like, oh my gosh, Kevin, you got a haircut. Looks nice. Like, before anyone else, he'll notice all these little details, and he'll always have these little comments to lift people up, but it's always done in a really quiet, personal way. So he's not the rah-rah cheerleader. That's more of my role, but he's the one who just notices everything.
I have another question about that, Jesse. Like, you know, athletes are known for debriefs. They're known for evaluations, and then also, like, planning with the future. So, you know, I mean, a North American athlete, like a Canadian or an American, of course, like, the Olympics looms large. So it's easy to kind of have, like, 4-year plans or go kind of use the Olympic cycle or maybe lengthen that out even. But a coach is it's a passion project, of course, and a professional athlete, like, you at your highest level, you're getting paid for what you do. Of course, it's a job. But at the other side of the coin is do you guys have specific conversations with, or has Cork had specific conversations with you about, like, I'm signing on for another 4 years, let's do it? Or has it just been like this unspoken understanding that, like, you and me, we're taking over the world, we're going to be the best, and then you guys are just making it happen? You're almost like manifesting it to happen. But the reason why I ask is because when you were saying, it's like, oh man, if Cork were to quit, like, I don't know what I quit to, haha, kind of thing. Is this something that you guys have discussed? Because it is a huge burden for Cork or a Matt Whitcomb, for example. Like, this is, as it is with yourself, as it is with the athletes. I'm not saying that, but that relationship, can you speak a bit to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's more of an unspoken thing. Like, I want to make sure that he is doing it because he loves it, not because he feels like obligated. But man, you'd be hard pressed to find a guy who just loves sport more. Like, he truly loves it, which is, it's just, to me, that is so cool. But we do have a planning meeting every spring. So we sit down and we go through and we debrief from the whole season. You know, what did we learn? Where can we improve? What went well? Yikes, let's not do that again. Like, and we go through the whole thing, and then we set down all the process goals and areas of focus for the next year. So we do this on a year-to-year basis. And that's a really, really important part of our process. And that's kind of the invisible stuff that also creates a lot of magic, because, I mean, this takes us hours, and we really sat down, like, here's all the things that I'm working on, down to, like, brainstorming specific technique drills and how many times a week are we going to do them and how many times we can look at video. And, like, we get really nitty gritty with it. And we sign on together to do that work. And I think that's a really special thing.
I was just going to say, if you need someone to take notes at that your debrief meeting, I'm available.
potentially. Nice
try. Yeah. This episode of the Devin Kershaw Show is brought to you by the Craftsbury Outdoor Center. I've spent a bunch of time racing and training at Craftsbury, which is in northern Vermont, and it really is the perfect place in the Northeast to unplug and get some good focus time skiing in the woods, particularly in the middle of the week when they don't have many people around Craftsbury and you can still eat the really good locally sourced food at the dining hall. It also costs less to visit Craftsbury outside the weekend. Lodging can be 20% off the weekend rates or more. For more information about Craftsbury, visit craftsbury.com. Cool. Well, I think that about wraps it up. I think, you know, the one question I'm sure probably a lot of people are wondering, just like, I think you've committed publicly that you're probably going to be racing through the next Olympics in Turin, which is 2 seasons from now. If I'm not mistaken, you're nodding for people who...
Cortina, Turin, man. That's my era.
Right. It's like,
we're going to Cortina, baby. We're in the Dolomites.
The cheeses and the risottos, like, compared to Beijing when you guys are unlocked. I feel like that's going to be a fun Olympics. all that being said, so I am curious, just like, what are your big goals for the, you know, it's sort of like this was a non-championships year, right? No Olympics, no world championships. And now we're kind of really next year and the year after, it's like we're really now building in a serious way into the Olympics. So like, what are your sort of big goals and visions for the next 2 years, which, like, you can correct me if I'm wrong, may be sort of getting toward the end of your career even?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's fair to say. Like, I'm 32. So we're in the fun zone right now, I think, which is really cool, because it feels like pretty much, I mean, literally as soon as I crossed the finish line of the sprint qualifier in Minneapolis, it was like everything I've ever wanted from my career, I got to do it. That was it. So everything here on out is a bonus, and it just needs to be fun. And I'm doing it because I want to do it. And that was one of the biggest things that I ever wanted, was just to race in my own country, and even more in front of my hometown and my grandparents and everyone. And that was like the most emotional moment of my whole career. But that said, looking forward, it's funny because the one thing I will tell you from those planning meetings that I do with Cork in April is that like 99.9% of all the goals are process. And for many, many years, we literally haven't even written outcome goals. Like, we didn't do it. We didn't even put them on paper, because at the end of the day, you're trying as hard as you can in all the races. Why bother writing like, what I would like to do is win, because like everyone would like to win. That's why we race. And really it's just about, you know, what I would like to do is improve my technique and my tactics and my power and speed, and find better ways to move from the from the quarterfinals through to the finals with good energy, you know. Like, I'm just so process and goal oriented. So it's interesting, because when I look for the next 2 years, like, yes, I would love to make the world championships team and the Olympics team and be there in a big way. And like, of course, we're always trying to get that 4x5 relay together at those championships. That's so cool. And such a cool, like, holy grail goal as a nation. And that would be really cool to contribute to that and to be in good enough shape to meaningfully contribute to that. But yeah, I honestly haven't gotten that far. Like, I don't have specific goals for those years beyond the fact that I want to be happy and healthy, or I don't want to be racing. And so if at any point it starts to become like, this is too much, like it's too hard to be on the road, it's too hard to be away from weight, it's too hard to be away from home, then I feel like, I hope anyway, that I will know when it's time. And right now it's not time, but I think when I get to that point, I'll know.
I had a small question. This would be my last question for you, Jesse, but I know with like my career, at least, like I was almost like addicted to chasing the perfect race, and what that perfect race was for me or for other people is different. But for me, it was like to be truly fully present, and it happened very seldomly. And like the one race that sticks out was a individual start race in Estonia. I didn't even win. I was third and like got crushed by Dario, but we're like, I was just on execute mode, and you're just like time and space is like ceasing to exist. You're in the true flow state, and your body, you know what to do. And it became like just such an addictive thing that I didn't care what the result was, but I wanted that feeling again. It was super, super elusive. Have you ever had any experiences like that where you can truly say it's like, man, I was in the zone. I don't remember anything. I was out of body. Like, I don't know what happened. The gun went off. I finished. I laid on the snow, got up. Oh my God. Or is that something that you see yourself in? Or is it more like you said, like the process type goals? Like, do you chase that feeling? Or is it more you just chase the constant improvement, the kind of like subtle improvement every day, every season type thing?
You know, it's funny because I know exactly what you're describing when you're describing that flow state, because I think probably most athletes have experienced that at least once, you know, that magic where you literally look back and you're like, I don't know what happened. I couldn't describe it to you. And that definitely happened at the 2018 Olympics and that team sprint. Like, that was a flow state thing for me, for sure. Like, I couldn't replicate it if I tried. And similarly, the 10K skate in Planitza World Champs. Like, it just, there's times when all the puzzle pieces click together and it's not worth even trying to take it apart ever again, because you can't. It's just that was it, and it was magic. But I think it is less about chasing that state for me, because I can also find that if I'm out on a really long epic trail run, or I can find it in little ways. Like, this is going to sound so stupid and cheesy, but like when I'm baking in my kitchen and I'm just so happy and involved in what I'm doing, like I will actually be in flow state sometimes. And it just is so great. And so I don't necessarily have to like trash my body to get it, which is kind of a relief, to be honest. Cause that means I have a chance of being like a 88-year-old grandma in flow state, baking a pie or something. But I think I am more driven by the idea of being that little bit better today than I was before. That to me is really, really addicting. Like the idea of like, I'm stacking another brick on the pile and I'm building something every time that I do that. And that is so satisfying to me.
Well, and it's got to be like at some level when you like look at what someone like Rosie Brennan or Paul Goldberg has like done in their like sort of, you know, a few years past you, to see the fact that like if you keep stacking those bricks, you can keep getting even better. Like that's got to be a hard thing to be thinking about in the context of like, is now the time to quit when I still could be getting significantly better?
I mean, I totally agree. Like, I think oftentimes we not give up, but we move on from something before we've fully seen our full potential, and in different areas of life, right? And I just think like it, I want to always know that I reached my full potential. And that's why I push so hard into the pain cave, is because then even if I'm dead last in the race, I can look back and I'm like, that was it. That was all I had to give. I have no questions, like no questions left unanswered. Like I will never wonder what I could have done if I had just held on a little bit more. And I think about my career in the same way, where when I walk away from it, I don't ever want to have questions of like, but what if I had just tried this or done this or done that. And so, yeah, so maybe I'll ski forever. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Jesse. Honestly, it's, I mean, it was incredible. You're a legend. What can you say? It's okay. And following along and cheering you on this season. I mean, I've known you for a long time and you've had a lot of great races and stuff. We've traveled together, but this season, I wasn't traveling with you because I'm long retired, but it just to follow along the season that you had was something incredibly inspiring, and in that you were willing to share a bit of the behind the scenes and the struggles with it too kind of makes the victory ever the sweeter in a way. But I really wish you that, I wish you a very restful spring, and looking forward to seeing you again next year and hearing the behind the scenes stuff of how things are going. And maybe one day we'll get to chat with Cork or something, but maybe not. It's always fun to catch up with them anyways, one-on-one when I see him. And, but I really, really, truly, deeply appreciate it, Jesse. So congratulations, and, yeah, best skier in the world, 2023, 2024. Think about that. That's quite the achievement. I know you've done that already before, but still this season itself was something pretty special, especially for what you overcame. So I tip my hat.
Aw, thanks, guys. It's really nice of you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Devin Kershaw Show. We'll be back soon.